It is Friday, November 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump departs for his trip to Asia, which is expected to focus on North Korea.
In terms of his ability to send messages to North Korea, I'm not sure that this trip is going to achieve a lot.
This week's terror attack in New York has reignited debate about the diversity lottery program, and costumes from New York productions find new life in other plays. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump has departed on a five-nation, 12-day trip to Asia. The White House says the threat from Pyongyang will be at the top of President Trump's agenda. Officials say the denuclearization of North Korea is the only acceptable outcome. Recent polls show Americans consider North Korea to be the most immediate threat to the United States. The president's talks with South Korean President Moon Jae-in and other world leaders are to center on questions about how to deal with Pyongyang's ongoing development of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. There's increasing anxiety on both sides of the Pacific about what Trump views as necessary to achieve his administration's vow to eliminate the threat to the United States posed by Pyongyang's weapons of mass destruction. I spoke with Ken Goss, director of the International Affairs Group at CNA, a nonprofit research and analysis group based in Arlington, Virginia.
I see this trip as mainly an opportunity for President Trump to reassure allies and have critical discussions with China. In terms of his ability to send messages to North Korea, I'm not sure that this trip is going to achieve a lot. I mean, it would show a certain amount of solidarity if he's able to have successful trips in Seoul, Tokyo, and in Beijing. But in terms of the U.S.-North Korean dynamic, we've seen really over the last month that the rhetoric has kind of calmed down a little bit. North Korea has not been engaged in missile and nuclear tests, although we expect that they probably will start that up here in the near future. You know, it remains to be seen, but I don't know how much President Trump is going to be able to achieve in the kind of the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and North Korea, but I see this trip as more of a kind of a his opportunity to reassure allies and get a better understanding with Beijing.
Yeah, there are reports that there are sort of back-channel communications going on, diplomatic communications going on between the United States and North Korea.
Yeah, but again, as long as the United States is talking solely about denuclearization, those talks are not going to go very far. The North Koreans are looking, I would suspect, for the art of the possible. If the U.S. is willing to put more on the table in terms of incentives, then they might be willing to have a discussion with the U.S. But if the U.S. is not willing to support economic and security incentives, I doubt that these back-channel talks are going to go very far.
What is known about the current status of North Korea's nuclear program?
Well, again, not a whole lot. We can kind of connect dots from what we have seen of previous and what we know of the steps that it would take to develop a viable nuclear deterrent that is able to hit the United States. We've observed, obviously, the nuclear programs in other countries as well as our own nuclear programs. But, you know, we know that the North Koreans have possibly been able to miniaturize a nuclear weapon to be able to put on a warhead. We know that by the number of tests they've had and certain signatures that those tests have provided. We have seen that they have still had some problems with reentry technology on their missile systems, which is another critical component that they haven't demonstrated yet. They haven't demonstrated yet that they can actually put a nuclear warhead on a missile. So all of these things are various steps that have yet to be proven. So we would say, you know, that's what leads most analysts to say that they're probably at least a year, if not longer, away from having such a capability.
How significant is China in relations for the United States to try to deal with North Korea?
Well, again, we would like China to put the, you know, really turn the screws to North Korea in terms of fuel oil and other resources because they are North Korea's primary patron, if not only patron. But we need to understand that China has its own equities, not only on the peninsula, but in the region. And a lot of those equities don't line up with the United States. And they don't want to be seen, and it really doesn't line up with their own strategic vision to be seen carrying the water for the United States. For the United States, nuclear proliferation is the number one issue here, not wanting North Korea to get a nuclear program. That is not the number one issue for China. China's number one issue is to have stability in the region and stability on its borders. And so they are not willing to push as hard as the United States would like. And no matter how much we try to pressure China, and I don't think that this trip to Beijing is going to make much difference in terms of getting China to do anything more than they're already doing with relationship to North Korea.
Ken Gause, Director of the International Affairs Group at CNA. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, the big story we were talking about this week was the social media company is going to Capitol Hill to testify about Russian interference. You had representatives of Facebook, Twitter, and Google there. Today we have a story about the CEO of a similar company related to the tech world, one of the biggest tech companies in the world, talking about social media, and that's Apple CEO Tim Cook telling NBC News, talking about the issue of Russian interference, that he does not feel that it's the biggest issue with social media. He says that he does not think that ads from foreign governments have that much of an influence. He says it's like 0.1% of the issue. Cook says his big issue is the divisiveness of social media. He says that's issue 1 through 10 for him, and he says that social networks need to focus more on that. Tim Cook is one of the most influential voices in technology, one of the most influential voices in Silicon Valley, so it's going to be interesting to see if social networks heed his call to address divisiveness. There have been efforts to do so in the past, overshadowed by the Russian influence and interference, but it does remain a pervasive issue, particularly as social media is used more and more as a tool for people to bicker back and forth. I can't tell you how many times we've talked about that on the show. I know that you know full well being on the other side of the dais here from me, but it's certainly an issue that is pervasive and one that is getting more attention now from a big name. So we'll see if it gets addressed down the road. But the big issue and the big topic trending today was a surprise on President Trump's Twitter page last night. Visitors to President Trump's Twitter account saw last night that it had been deactivated. And when you clicked on his account, you were greeted with a message that said, "Sorry, that page does not exist." So what happened? Was this a glitch? Did Trump take his account offline? Well, it turns out it was a Twitter employee on his last day of work briefly deactivating President Trump's Twitter account. I guess if you're going out, go out in a, you know, in a fashion that, you figure you're not going to get fired, so why not go and do whatever you want? Twitter said it was deactivated initially due to an error, but then they came clean later on. Some were jokingly asking if Trump was still president if he didn't have a Twitter account. Some wondering if it was taken down before they knew the real answer because of maybe some legal trouble if his lawyers advised him to take it down. President Trump was among those that noticed. He said this morning on Twitter, "My Twitter account was taken down for 11 minutes by a rogue employee. I guess word must be finally getting out, having an impact." So just goes to show you, you never know what people are going to do, even in the world of technology. It's all people pulling the levers and the buttons behind the scenes. And as I saw one person recommend on Twitter to this person, this rogue employee, they said, "You might want to get a lawyer." I think this is an issue that might be a bit of a problem for that employee, even though he doesn't work for Twitter anymore.
All right. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. targets Islamic State in northern Somalia. President Trump calls the Russia probes a disgrace and wants a Justice Department probe of Hillary Clinton. Turkey deploys more forces in northern Syria, and the bodies of U.S. soldiers killed in Niger were found bloodied and stripped. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. Scientists who sent a unique experiment up to the International Space Station have learned that bacteria can be quite adaptable in order to survive. A group of scientists led by researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder found bacterial cells, when treated with a common antibiotic in the near weightlessness of space, resorted to maneuvers such as shape-shifting to avoid being destroyed. Researchers cultured some E. coli bacteria on the space station and then exposed it to an antibiotic that normally kills it on Earth. They found that rather than being wiped out by the antibiotic, the number of microbes increased by 13 times and behaved in other ways that may have added even more protection from the antibiotics. Researchers say their findings have implications for those in space and on Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, some old costumes get some new life in New York. The Islamic State has claimed 29-year-old Saifullah Saipov as one of its own. The terrorist group said in its group's weekly newspaper Al-Naba that the New York City attacker was one of its soldiers, but did not provide any evidence to support its claim. This week's attack in New York City that killed 8 people and injured 12 others has rekindled the debate here in the U.S. about immigration. President Trump said Wednesday that Uzbek national Saipov used the 27-year-old diversity lottery program to enter the U.S. legally in 2010. Mr. Trump said he will urge Congress to get rid of the program aimed at providing a path to resident status for people from countries with historically low rates of immigration to the U.S.
It sounds nice. It's not nice. It's not good. It's not good. It hasn't been good. We've been against it. So we want to immediately work with Congress on the diversity lottery program, on terminating it, getting rid of it. We want a merit-based program where people come into our country based on merit. And we want to get rid of chain migration. This man that came in brought in with him other people. He was the point of contact, the primary point of contact for, and this is preliminarily, 23 people that came in or potentially came in with him. And that's not acceptable.
Mr. Trump later in a tweet linked Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, to the lottery program, which had bipartisan support and was signed into law by then-President George H.W. Bush in 1990. Schumer responded during a news conference.
The president ought to stop tweeting and start leading. The American people long for leadership, not divisiveness, not finger-pointing, not name-calling. This is a tragedy. It's less than a day than after it occurred, and he can't refrain from his nasty, divisive habits. He ought to lead, and the best way he can lead is increase anti-terrorism funding.
Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director for the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, any debate about changes to immigration law should be done thoughtfully and deliberately.
The lottery program has actually been quite successful, and even people from both sides of the aisle, such as Republican Congressman King from New York, has spoke about the value of these programs. I think it's always good to reassess policies based on changing conditions. But what I and other analysts worry about is that this can oftentimes boil down to more of a reflexive response that's oftentimes based on bias rather than facts. Indeed, Uzbekistan was not even on the list of banned countries. So what we have to understand is our problem is more so radicalization, not necessarily immigration, because we have people who are converts or who are unstable that are being radicalized by social media or peer group members. And that's a problem that making a reflexive response with regard to immigration simply isn't going to solve.
So what should the direction of the focus be in the wake of this attack in New York?
I think we should have a multipolar focus, which includes trying to get as much of this extremist content off the web as possible. Number two, I certainly agree with vetting people who are coming from places where there is a problem of extremism. But if we start to go down the road where we're focusing on religion only, I think it's going to be a failed policy, number one, and number two, it's anathema to what this country stands for with respect to religious pluralism.
How do you regulate the internet?
Much of the regulation that is going to take place has to come from the social media companies. And indeed, if there is a story that has not been as aggressively reported, it is that these companies have been doing a good job to the extent that they can of cleaning up much, but not all of the extremist content. The problem is it then merges over to the dark web or to offshore platforms like VK, the Russian Facebook, and also platforms like Telegram, which are much harder to regulate because they are offshore entities. But the bottom line is we have to make it less accessible for unstable individuals to find extremist content. This is actually a sign of how degraded groups like ISIS actually are, because as they've lost the ability to control geography and to bring in foreign fighters, they now have to revert to getting unstable and unsophisticated people to drive trucks, as opposed to being able to orchestrate mass attacks involving numerous people and numerous targets.
That's Brian Levin of California State University. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. On any night, there are dozens of shows running in New York and hundreds of actors needing costumes to create the characters for those plays. Ever wonder what happens to custom-made costumes after a show closes? Well, some of them get a whole new life thanks to one of the largest costume rental places in the United States. But it's not a commercial outfit. It's TDF, the Theater Development Fund, which is most famous for running booths with discount tickets to Broadway shows. Reporter Naomi Lewin reports.
If you were a little kid who liked to play dress-up, this place would knock your Wicked Witch of the West socks off.
We have a little bit of everything here. We have some odd pieces, like I see a strawberry. I see a bunch of skeletons.
Is that an elephant head?
That is an elephant head.
Stephen Cabral is director of the costume collection at the Theater Development Fund, TDF for short. The not-for-profit is dedicated to making theater more accessible through ticket, education, and disability programs. TDF got into the costume business in the mid-1960s, when the Metropolitan Opera was about to move into a new home in Lincoln Center.
They had 22 full operas that they knew that they would not be taking with them, but they didn't want to just toss away. So TDF took on all of these old productions from the Met and began to, at a very, very, very inexpensive rate, rent out these costumes
to anyone who's doing a performance anywhere in the United States.
We're not renting for Halloween, and we're not renting for parties with food or liquids where something could happen to the costume. But if you're doing something that seems of an artistic nature in some way, we're going to be able to rent to you.
Money from those rentals goes to pay the nonprofit's staff and for overhead. The collection is housed in a vast subterranean space three flights down from the largest soundstage east of Hollywood. All of the costumes are donated. They include Bob Mackie gowns designed for Carol Burnett, Shakespearean garb from the Public Theater, and dresses from Broadway shows.
These are both from the musical Gypsy. This is from a production on Broadway with Bernadette Peters.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay.
It's very flirty. It's very light. It's very short. She's not very tall to begin with.
Some people can thrive and bloom, living life in a living room.
Then you have this costume, which was worn by Patti LuPone in Gypsy.
You'll never get away from me. You can climb the tallest tree. I'll be there somehow.
This is a three-piece brown wool suit, probably 1920s, 30s. It has this blouse underneath that's bright autumnal silk.
Cabral points out a gown from a Met production of Lucia di Lammermoor.
It is very Elizabethan, but done metropolitan opera, so the sleeves are a little longer and the fabric is a little bit more ornate.
This particular gown was once shipped to an opera company in the Midwest. Afterwards, Cabral got a phone call saying,
"You had one of my singers in tears last night." The person being fitted for this costume was a young opera singer, and when she saw the costume and saw that it had a Metropolitan Opera label, and it said Lucia, and it said wedding scene, and it said Beverly Sills, the young woman broke down because she couldn't believe that she was so fortunate to not only wear a Metropolitan Opera, but to wear something by Beverly Sills.
Costumes from the Met are built to last, so when they arrive, they go into a small room of special stock. After these costumes have seen their share of use, they're moved into regular stock. And once they start looking shabby, they might go into the distressed section, or they could go straight to the semi-annual bag sale, where Cabral says there's a set price for everything you can stuff into one bag.
And the rule is we just don't ever want to see the costume again.
Because there's always a new crop of donations waiting for space on the TDF racks. For VOA News, I'm Naomi Lewin in New York.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 34 years since the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, Lebanon. At a ceremony honoring the 241 Americans who were killed during the mission to keep peace in that war-torn country, Vice President Mike Pence said that the attack was the opening salvo in a war that we have waged ever since, the global war on terror.
It's a conflict that has taken American troops across the wider world, from Lebanon to Libya, from Nigeria to Afghanistan, from Somalia to Iraq, and many other battlefields in between.
Vice President Pence called radical Islamic terrorism a hydra with many heads, which the Trump administration is committed to defeat. Hezbollah is the terrorist organization which planned and perpetrated the Beirut attack. Under President Donald Trump, Mr. Pence said, the United States has redoubled efforts to cripple Hezbollah's terrorist network and bring its leaders to justice.
Our administration announced rewards for information leading to location, arrest, and conviction of two of Hezbollah's senior-most leaders, including Fuad Shakur, one of the masterminds behind the bombing of the Marine Corps barracks.
But Hezbollah is merely a proxy for the leading state sponsor of terrorism, said Vice President Pence. And President Donald Trump has put Iran on notice that we will no longer tolerate their support of terrorism.
As the president often says, he has no higher priority than the safety and security of the American people. And we will fight tirelessly to defeat the specter of radical Islamic terror, no matter where it rears its ugly head.
That also means in Afghanistan, U.S. forces will remain engaged in the fight against the Taliban and all terrorist groups until the menace to our homeland is eliminated. And beyond the hard-won victories in Iraq and Syria, the U.S. will continue to hunt down and destroy ISIS at its source so it can no longer threaten our people, our allies, and our way of life. The war on terror began 34 years ago, said Vice President Pence, and brave Americans continue the fight. We honor their service and sacrifice, renewing our pledge that their sacrifice we remember today will not have been in vain. And as a nation, we resolve that under the leadership of President Donald Trump, we will drive the cancer of terrorism from the face of the earth.